This is an ABC podcast.
If a person is brutally attacked but doesn't die immediately, does that count as murder?
The 78-year-old victim was attacked and badly injured when William Rodney Swan and another man broke into his home. The man's quality of life deteriorated so badly in the 8 months after the assault, he died when a choice was made not to opt for an operation on a broken hip. The High Court was asked to rule that it wasn't open to the jury to convict Swan of murder. But today the court found the assault did contribute in a significant way to the death, and the jury decision was correct.
We'll be exploring what this decision might mean for the Ruby Princess and any criminal charges that might arise from the New South Wales Homicide Squad's investigation into the COVID-19 deaths and infections connected to the ill-fated cruise. And
Federal police have raided the Canberra home of a senior journalist for publishing classified information which police say had the potential to undermine Australia's national security.
Today, Ms. Smithhurst's home was raided by federal police. The journalist was questioned, police seizing her computer and mobile phone, searching for the source.
Like, they've gone through, you know, the oven, all her drawers, her underwear drawer.
They were there for 7 hours.
It is an absolute attempt to intimidate journalists, you know, and more importantly, to intimidate sources.
The AFP says it's investigating the alleged publishing of information classified as an official secret that has the potential to undermine security.
When the Australian Federal Police raid a journalist's home using a dodgy search warrant, should police be allowed to hold on to the seized material? Hi, Damien Carrick here. Welcome to the Law Report. Today, focusing on two very different High Court of Australia decisions. First, to what sounds like, on the face of it, a victory for press freedom. Seven judges of the High Court found that a police search warrant executed on the home of Canberra journalist Annika Smethurst was invalid and should be quashed. But many, in both media and legal circles, say the ruling exposes dangerous gaps in our legal protection for public interest journalism. Peter Bartlett, partner with Minta Ellison, is one of Australia's leading media lawyers. He, like many lawyers and journalists, says the decision highlights an urgent need for legislative reform.
The raid was in June 2019. It was on Annika's private home. It related to articles that she had written about the boosting of the Australian Signals Directorate's cyber capabilities.
It was about whether or not the Department of Defence and the Department of Home Affairs were considering a proposal to expand the powers of Australian government to secretly spy on Australian citizens without a warrant. And presumably the sources for this story were inside government.
Potentially, but you're right in describing the articles in that way. And you would imagine that these are articles that the public really has a right to know what government is doing, what government instrumentalities and organisations are doing. It was a serious invasion of her house. You're correct in describing the action taken by the High Court in unanimously ruling that the search warrant was invalid. And the High Court found that it was invalid on drafting grounds, not on the merits of whether there should be a search warrant against Annika. They found that the search warrant on its face was ambiguous and poorly drafted and didn't consider the more important issues of whether such a search warrant should be issued against a journalist in these circumstances. The third ground that Annika was challenging the warrant was on the grounds of the implied freedom in the Constitution on political communication. But the High Court, because it found on the drafting issues that the warrant was invalid, it didn't go on to consider that third, more important issue of whether the section in the Crimes Act enabling the issuing of this warrant was infringed, whether the implied freedom of political communication in the Constitution had been infringed.
So it didn't look at, if you like, these big picture issues. The judges essentially unanimously said that this warrant was poorly drafted and did not, as it was required to do under the legislation, specify exactly what offence was being investigated. But four out of the judges went on to say that while we think this warrant is totally shonky, that doesn't mean that the police have to return the seized copies of documents, which they downloaded onto USB sticks, to Annika Smethurst. And they don't have to never use it in any criminal investigations or proceedings. But three out of the seven of the judges of the High Court took the opposite view. They said it would be illogical to allow police to gain or to benefit from an illegal warrant.
And that's something that we would all have sympathy for. So how can we have a situation where the seven of the judges in a 115-page judgment have taken the view that this search warrant was illegal and should never have been issued, and therefore the AFP is not entitled to actually have these documents because it obtained them through an illegal process. And yet the majority of the court said that they would not order that the material seized be returned because they had doubts as to whether they had the power. But they also noted that Smethurst was still under investigation and so that charges may be laid against her. And on that basis, the AFP is entitled to retain the documents. That just seems illogical.
So where does this leave journalist Annika Smethurst and her employer News Corp and potentially the whistleblower, if there was one? They could still face charges and this information could still be used against them?
Certainly the AFP retains all of the material that's been seized. It can use that material to lay charges and to prosecute. But they face a significant risk, I would have thought, that in the light of the High Court saying that the raid was illegal, the search warrant was illegal, that a court in a prosecution may well take the view that the AFP can't use the material illegally seized.
Peter Bartlett, so far we've been talking about the raid on the Canberra home of News Corp journalist Annika Smethurst, but there was another high-profile raid on the media at the ABC studios in Sydney, and they were raided, I think, on the 5th of June 2019, the day following the raid on Annika Smethurst's home. Why was the ABC raided? And then what happened when the ABC challenged that raid in the Australian Federal Court?
Over the last 10, 20 years, it's been very rare that police authorities have executed search warrants on the media. So to have two raids, one against News Limited, one against the ABC in 2 days, was quite extraordinary. The ABC raids related to reports of unlawful killings in Afghanistan.
By Australian Special Forces.
By Australian Special Forces. And so the AFP turned up at the ABC offices in Sydney and demanded access to all of the source material. The ABC complied and cooperated with the AFP, but then later challenged the search warrant. And in February this year, February 2020, Justice Abraham in the Federal Court rejected all of the ABC grounds of challenge. And that, I think, was a very disappointing decision for the ABC. But the judge took the view that the drafting of the search warrant was, in fact, valid. She actually took the view that the ABC's submission elevates source protection to a position which, on the current law, state of the law, it does not have. And the shield laws protecting journalist sources had no application, because search warrants weren't referred to in the relevant legislation. And that was understandable because the judge was simply following the wording of the appropriate law, but was a very disappointing decision for the ABC.
So as you see it, what's the big picture here? What do you think needs to be done to restore the balance between the power of the state and the freedom of the press to hold the state to account when they raise public interest issues?
There was a very interesting paper put out by the Law Council of Australia a couple of days ago, in the light of this Smethurst decision. And I agree with the comments made by the Law Council. And it said there should be a three-staged process. Number one, a judge of a superior court should authorise a warrant, a search warrant. Whereas in these cases, it was a registrar of a court and a magistrate. Secondly, the judge should consider a statutory public interest test. And that, I think, would be very important. Is it in the public interest that this search warrant be authorised? And thirdly, there should be a public interest advocate. And that person should be consulted so that there should be a not just the AFP view or the state police view that this search warrant should be issued. There should be someone independent, a barrister, who would give an argument to the court, the judge, that potentially the public interest justifies this material being published and the search warrant should not be issued. I think that they would be very significant reforms to be introduced.
Is there any realistic likelihood that the government will introduce this kind of legislation? Because that's what's required here, right?
It is required. And when we look at Australia is involved with this Five Eyes intelligence, for example, and Canada, New Zealand and the United States all have protections for journalists. So that it's very troubling that Australia is out on its own of having no basic protection, adequate protection for journalists. It's a very troubling state of affairs for press freedom in this country. The chances of reform, I wouldn't be overconfident.
Peter Bartlett, one of Australia's leading media lawyers, ending that conversation on a sobering note. But Peter is a partner with Minta Ellison. I'm Damien Carrick and this is The Law Report on Radio National. And of course it's available anytime, anywhere, wherever you get your podcasts. As we know, the New South Wales Homicide Squad is investigating the COVID-19 deaths and infections connected with the Ruby Princess cruise ship. So how could management or staff or a corporation be held criminally liable for fatalities which occurred well after passengers left the ill-fated cruise ship? Well, a recent High Court decision involving a violent home invasion may provide some guidance. Professor Ali Luthman, a criminal law expert based at the University of Sydney Law School, says the case involved the brutal bashing of an elderly Russian-speaking man. His name was Alexander Kormeletz. He lived alone in a Department of Housing apartment in the Sydney suburb of Redfern.
He was a 78-year-old man living in his own home, and by all the evidence before the courts, he had an independent life. His son visited him, but he was active in going out and looking after himself. He was subject to a break-in, and as a result of the break-in, he suffered severe injuries to his brain, his face, his kidneys and his chest.
This was back in 2013 and he was viciously attacked in his home by William Rodney Swan and an accomplice. What happened after that?
He was hospitalised for 4 months where he received significant assistance to recover, but he was still requiring high-level care after that 4 months and he was transferred to a care facility. But his mental and physical condition remained poor. So he was actually then unable to undertake the daily activities involved in living. He couldn't comprehend simple tasks and he was a bit disoriented. And as a result, he was getting out of bed or attempting to get out of bed by himself. And that was something that he could no longer do. He needed assistance to move around.
8 months after the assault, he falls out of bed and he's discovered on the floor and he suffers this fracture to his left femur, the main bone in his thigh. What happens at that point?
At that point, a decision is made not to operate on Mr. Kormeletz and he dies in hospital shortly after that fracture.
So a decision is made by a family who deeply love him
not to operate. They sort of say, look, this we see as the best way forward. And this operation might have saved his life, but he's in a difficult, compromised state anyway, isn't he?
That's right. And the decision was made, according to the Crown evidence, on the basis that Mr. Cormillet's quality of life was not good at that point, and he'd had previous procedures in hospital. And while the surgery was reasonably expected to save his life, the family made the decision that the surgery would not go ahead, and Mr. Cormillet dies shortly after the fall.
So Swan is charged with murder for this death, which occurs 8 months after they meet when he viciously attacks him in his Redfern apartment. What is the argument of the prosecution, which the jury accept? They find him guilty of murder. What's the thrust of their argument?
So the Crown argued that the defendant, Mr. Swan, could be liable for Mr. Cormillet's death on one of three bases, and each of the three bases requires the defendant to have caused the death. And while there can be more than one cause, if the cause that the defendant's responsible for, here the serious assault that occurred in Mr. Cormillet's home, continues to be an operating or substantial cause at the time of the death, then it's open to the jury to find the defendant liable for that death. And in this case, that's what the jury found. They convicted Mr. Swan of murder.
So they find him guilty. He's sentenced to a lengthy period of imprisonment. Swan appeals. What's the basis of his appeal to the High Court?
Mr. Swan argues that the Crown's claim that it was one of three ways to hold him liable for the death of Mr. Cormillet's, that the third way in which he could help be held liable was not open to the jury on the facts. So in other words, it was not an appropriate argument made by the Crown because it wasn't supported by the facts, according to Mr. Swan. So the third way in which the Crown argued Mr. Cormillet's could have died as a result of Mr. Swan's actions was that the assault was so severe that the low quality of life Mr. Cormillet's had after the assault meant that it was reasonable in those circumstances to make a decision when he fell and broke his neck not to operate on him. And as we know, that was just shortly before he died in hospital.
And the High Court, when they heard this argument from Swan's lawyer, they just unanimously rejected it. What did they say?
That's right, Damien. They said that it was open to the jury to conclude that even though surgery on Mr. Cormillet's would reasonably be expected to save his life, his low quality of life at that point meant that the decision not to operate was an understandable one. And so even though the man died 8 months after the assault in his home, the assault itself remained what is legally required for liability here, a substantial cause of the death of Mr. Cormillet's. And given that that was the case, the jury's decision to convict, if they made it on the basis of that third option, because of course we don't know how they made their decision, then that was an acceptable basis for holding Mr. Swan liable.
So I guess the idea is that sometimes there can be, after the injury sustained in an attack, there can be kind of intervening events or decisions which then impact on whether a person lives or dies. But that doesn't negate somebody's ultimate responsibility for a murder. Have there been similar cases?
There have, Damien. And one of the most famous cases in this area is a decision called Blau, in which a victim who was injured declined a blood transfusion because she was a Jehovah's Witness and died after having declined that blood transfusion. And the court in that case, when the defendant argued that that victim's actions in declining a blood transfusion constituted a break in the chain of causation, was a stop, if you like, from his responsibility or his liability to hers, her independent decision. The court said that it did not lie in the mouth of the defendant to say what was reasonable on the part of the victim.
So a vicious physical attack on a stranger or a family member that doesn't lead to an immediate death, that can lead to a successful murder conviction. But what about in this time of COVID-19, what about spreading communicable diseases? Can that lead to criminal charges? And have there been any cases involving any type of communicable disease?
There have been, Damien, and it won't be surprising to the listeners to know that the kind of cases in this area are related to HIV and AIDS, which, as we know, is transmitted through sexual contact.
So there have been successful convictions for grievous bodily harm or even for murder or manslaughter involving people who had sex with a partner and either deliberately kept it from them that they were HIV positive, or, I don't know, a stealth rape kind of thing where you actually take off a condom. So there have been criminal convictions for that kind of behaviour leading to physical harm or death.
It is possible for a communicable disease to be the basis of an assault or a murder charge, and that's because a way of committing murder or assault is by reference to grievous bodily harm, and that's the legal expression for really serious harm. And if a defendant transmits a disease to a victim, that can be one form of grievous bodily harm.
Okay, what about the Ruby Princess cruise ship? As we speak, the COVID-19 virus has claimed the lives of 21 passengers. It's infected some 600 passengers and 200 crew on this ill-fated voyage, which sailed from Sydney to New Zealand before turning around and docking back in Sydney back in March. And in New South Wales, there are now a number of investigations. There's a special commission of inquiry that's investigating all aspects of government and government agency decision-making around its departure and return to Sydney. There's also most likely going to be a coronial inquiry or inquest. And we've also seen the New South Wales Homicide Squad commence a criminal investigation. Could individuals or corporations be criminally liable? What sorts of offences are we talking about? And are we talking murder and manslaughter, potentially?
Potentially, Damien, manslaughter. This is the kind of case where either individuals could be liable or possibly the corporation, the ship's operator, Princess Cruises. So the question seemed to be, in the police inquiry and the Special Commission of Inquiry, who knew what when? Because what seems to be most important is the kind of information that individuals had about the state of health of passengers and crew and what actions were taken at particular times. As we know, the information we have about the virus is developing quickly, and so we'd have to think back to the moments of the departure of the cruise liner, its docking back in Sydney, and then the decisions about release of the passengers onto the shore. As we know, with corporate criminal liability, it can be very difficult to charge a corporation with a homicide, although it's possible under the common law, because it's necessary for very senior people in the organisation to have the relevant knowledge. So a question of what they knew.
So we're talking about corporate responsibility. I mean, presumably you could maybe also lay charges against individuals who, we don't know the facts yet, but who might have potentially lied to New South Wales authorities or Australian authorities in their dealings with them, and that then impacted on a decision to allow the ship to dock or the passengers to exit the boat.
Yes, Damien. So individuals could be liable here, and as you say, it depends on who those individuals were and what they knew at what time, and also the corporation as a whole. And we have a decision from the English courts that has produced a doctrine that's been held to apply in Australia, and that's the identification doctrine. That means that to hold a corporation liable, we need to have individuals who are the directing mind and will of the company, so very high up, for those individuals to be constitute the corporation itself, and therefore for the corporation to be liable. The type of individuals who could be liable, as we could imagine, might be the ship's captain, senior crew, or perhaps management members of the ship's operator, Princess Cruises. So it could be that we see individuals held liable as well as the corporation. But as we know, it's difficult to hold corporations liable for corporate homicide under the criminal law. That can be a very challenging case to make.
Have we seen any analogous cases here?
The most prominent case in the area, Damien, is an English case involving the Herald of Free Enterprise ferry that capsized in the English Channel in the late 1980s after having left port with its bow doors open.
Oh, the Zeebruges disaster as it left the Belgian port of Zeebruges to go to Dover.
Yes, Damien, that's right. And as you'd be aware, there was a loss of life in that case of over nearly 200 people. And there were several inquiries following that disaster.
And that was about the failure to close the doors of the car ferry as it left port. So it kind of sank pretty instantly as it left Zeebruges.
Yes, Damien, exactly. It took on water through the bow doors and then sank. And as you might imagine, it was not the official operating process to leave port with the doors open. But the inquiries that followed the disaster found that that had been a practice of ferries at that time because it meant that they could depart more quickly. But the subsequent inquiries found that that was the cause of the disaster and also that it was a sign that the corporation and its management had been negligent. But there wasn't actually a conviction following that disaster because while charges were laid and the prosecution commenced, the prosecution was suspended for lack of evidence against the most senior members of the corporation. And as we're saying, it's necessary to find the most senior members of an organisation have the requisite mental state for the charge in order to convict a corporation. It's not enough that more junior employees who don't direct the mind and will of the corporation had, say, for example, acted negligently. And we must remember, too, that, of course, the standard in criminal law for negligence is gross negligence. It has to be very serious negligence, very serious failure to live up to the standard of the reasonable person. And while there was very serious criticism levied at the corporation and its management as a result of that disaster, it didn't result in criminal convictions of the corporation or the individuals involved.
So the issues around the Zeebruges disaster of 1987 potentially might be of use in terms of how we move forward with the Ruby Princess.
Yes, we're still in early stages of the inquiries and it's necessary to find out lots of the detail in order to determine what kind of outcomes will follow from the investigations. But at its most serious end, it is possible to think about charges of manslaughter. It will remain to be seen what is unearthed through the Special Commission of Inquiry and the police inquiry, as well as the possible coronial inquiry.
Professor Ali Luffman, thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you, Damien.
That's the Law Report. A big thank you to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer this week, Selwyn Cousins. Don't forget you can follow us on Twitter at LawReportRN or me personally on @Damien_Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.